Hi, this is Clay Boykin, and I am in search of the new compassionate male. Today, my producer, Dennis Tardon, and I had the opportunity to visit with Ian McKenzie, award-winning filmmaker, author, and speaker. Here's that conversation.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis. I'm the producer of A Conversation With and In Search Of with Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hey, Dennis. How are you today?
Well, we are in search of the new compassionate male, and we found one. Captured one in captivity from off the coast of Canada, right near Vancouver. His name is Ian McKenzie. Hello, Ian.
Hey, Dennis. Hey, Clay. Good to be here.
Thank you. One of the things, when Clay and I were talking right beforehand, one of the things that we wanted to learn from you is that you have spent so much of your time as a filmmaker working in the field of women's empowerment, helping to unleash the divine feminine, unleash that. And so could you talk about that journey and what impelled you to go there so we could understand a little bit more about you and your history? Who was born in 1981, I understand. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. You were 81. I was 48, Clay.
Gosh. Well, I'm 66 now, so let's do
right.
the math.
All right. So that gives us an across history of where we are. So mm-hmm. now take it away, Ian.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. I think the project you're referring to is called Amplify Her, which is
yes.
yeah, which is initially started as an idea for a documentary film. And I can share a bit more about that. But then from the initial idea of a documentary film, I connected with a co-producer, co-director named Nicole Sorkin, and it expanded and became a motion comic series, a graphic novel, a soundtrack, like a whole universe, which is still actually being released these days. And so that journey for me really launched when I, like all good stories, it starts with this one time at Burning Man. Mm-hmm. And I've already been going to that, you know, kind of, I don't know what to call it. It's not a festival per se, but it's like a gathering, a confluence
sure.
in the desert. And back, this is maybe 2011 or so, I experienced an artist there, a particular artist named Applecat, who she was combining some kind of, I don't know, combination of this dark but cosmic, you know, something, alchemy with her music. Mm-hmm. And I had already done a little bit of sort of mythological exploration, and the archetype came forward of the dark feminine. Like there was just something about that. I wasn't quite sure what that meant. And that really launched me on this inquiry of like, what's she doing? Does she know she's doing it? And what is that particular something that she's doing? And that launched again, like an inquiry. I interviewed her, and then that became kind of a thread that was pulled where I really dove into a kind of archetypal exploration of this side of the feminine, which, you know, I think largely women in this culture tend to be looked to for particular qualities, right, of nurturance, of compassion, of just, you know, I would call them more like light qualities, qualities of the light. And they're sort of not really allowed to be or to embody qualities that I consider more of the dark or the shadow or the underworld, you know, whereas cultures in the past, of course, had a very holistic kind of allowance, you know, for the full spectrum. And I think part of a lot of the women's resurgence now, at least in this latest wave, I think building upon, you know, the books of something like, or Clarissa, you know, Pinkola's and in other kind of gender mythology, you could say, that there's been a real resurgence. And I even noticed in pop culture, you know, after I started exploring this, that there was a lot of this kind of terminology was being used. And this kind of revolt of the patriarchal daughter, you know, could be one way to think about it as well, that women are saying, you know, no more, I'm not willing to be in that dynamic anymore. And they're claiming their power. So using the mythological lens through, you know, something that can be very esoteric, like again, this idea of the rise of the feminine, I felt like, well, what if we told the story through these artists, you know, through these DJs and producers, and, you know, could we make it more visible that way to see their real life stories? And we did. And then we also projected them into the mythological realm where they really claimed their own origin stories and their gifts that, you know, had come from their deepest wounds.
Clay, you've been, this What we've been doing, Ian, what I joined Clay recently, I say recently in less than a year, is that because Clay, you've been in search of the new compassionate male. This is the new archetype. We're talking about how if the patriarchy is crumbling in the quantum age and what we're doing and going to new nodal, what is going to replace it. So here we have the new archetype for the women as we're doing. And Clay, this has been your journey.
Well, yes. And I was really excited, Ian. I was just listening to your interview with Michael Mead. Mm-hmm. What a powerful mm-hmm. interview that was. And you know, going through and talking about the archetypes and so forth. And I really liked what he talked about you can't codify one. Mm-hmm. And he talked about the king, warrior, magician, lover, and, how he, said, okay, but again, you can't codify it. And so he pushed back a little bit on that. What I've come to find over the past 8 years that I've been in earnest looking is that with all the change that's happening, that there's a burn inside men and they're trying to figure out what that is. And I believe that that's the essence of their real truth and that is really trying to come up right now and express itself in its natural state, which is a state of love played out in compassion. And that if we use those four archetype, if we just say, okay, that's okay right now, king, warrior, magician, lover, that each one of them possess this element of compassion, that's really the drawing point where they can all point to that common theme. It's played out differently. It's played out differently for the lover than it is the warrior. It's sometimes played out soft. It's other times it's hard. So that's what I've been exploring. And I can't define that archetype. So that's why I'm in search of, and that's what's why I'm so excited for us to be talking, because I've just got I've just gotten a high level, view of what you're doing, and I'm thrilled.
And that's why we wanted to dig into your cellular journey, because as you made this decision and you said, wait a minute, there's something here for me to begin to explore. And your podcasts are going so deep. And so what was it that what were some of the elements that impelled you to begin this next chapter of all your producing that you could have chosen?
Thank you. I just had a minute. My young son just popped in and
hey,
he's just grabbing a couple of things.
All right,
good timing. Yeah, no, my partner, she's swooped him out of here, so he's on his way. But yeah, he's about 21 months now, so it's
nice. Oh, wow, congratulations!
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, talk about revisiting the inner child and the outer child and all that stuff too. So that's a whole other thread. But I think for me, the shift from studying and exploring the feminine archetypes coming from this, I think really the sincere wish to be helpful, to be helpful to this time. And I think I don't know if Iron John, he talks about this, but this idea that, if men who have some degree of sensitivity are able to look out at the world, right, and see what feels like, the ongoing mayhem from largely wrought at the hands of men, is kind of what it can feel like. Yeah, that there's a reaction to that, which is, whoa, I don't want to be that, I'm going to be a nice guy. I'm not going to do that. And so what happens, and this is what happened to me, is that I somewhat, disassociated or disconnected from my masculinity, or at least a kind of aspirational masculinity that held any kind of noble qualities, right? Because it was all seen as, oh, I don't want that. So, and that created a split within myself. And I think a lot of men feel that, right? On one hand, they're like, okay, I don't want to be that. But they don't really have pathways to a kind of, like a noble, compassionate, masculinity. And so, I think when I started this journey, first with the feminine, and then, like I said, I went through Clarissa and Dancing the Flames, or Marion Woodman, others like that. And then I suddenly was like, oh, wait, there's, Iron John. And I came to that through an incredible story actually connecting through my grandfather in his records, you know, after he died. It's an incredible story. But I recognized, I was like, oh, there's actually been an inquiry into this that had been called the Mythopoetic Men's Movement. Mm-hmm. Right. And I suspect, yeah, like both of you had been there and you know, like it was very alive for you. And I feel largely went underground, at least until more recently, the last few years, where I feel it's coming through a resurgence. So I would call it maybe the second wave of the Mythopoetic. And this is like the interview I did with Mead, where I really felt, oh, wow, like I felt an urgency to actually connect the generations, because I felt like the newer generations were a little almost like too disconnected from the lessons of the past, you know, a little bit like, oh, well, we can reinvent the wheel again. And yeah, the olders are kind of like, hey, look, we learned a lot. And yeah, you don't need to, you know, you don't need to kind of go through all the challenges that we did.
Diversity and inclusion means diversity and inclusion. It just does.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it is a way of saying, okay, look, don't, you know, like you're stronger together. That's kind of what I was recognizing. And so that's a piece about why I recognize, oh, wow, like to draw forth, you know, these, you know, pillaring or towering pillars like Mead, and I'm looking to interview like Melodoma Somme and others, you know, to really bring forth that time, specifically the historical context. Because this is also why I feel it's really important, because often when you talk about things like archetypes and almost like they're kind of universal, free-floating, always there, you know, understandings, the challenge is you lose the historical context of what was going on at the time. And I actually interviewed the Mankind Project, you know, Bill Koth, you know, co-founder as well. And I asked him in a way to bind the journey of Mankind Project and their own experiences to history and to cultural moment, of which a lot of this grew out of the response from the women, of course, right, who had started to do all this deep work. And the men were like, whoa, okay, we got to respond somehow. And that's really where this kind of gauntlet was thrown down to say, you know, over to you guys too. And so I felt like I needed to kind of update and bring forth the context for the current generation, but then also expand maybe the horizons of what was included, right? And this is where I've now interviewed people like Bayo Okomolafe, who's a Nigerian poet, and people like Dallas Goldtooth, who's an indigenous, you know, Standing Rock activist, and bringing forth, like I would call it more of an indigenous, you know, lens, indigenous cosmologies to just expand the context and to bring forth, yeah, like how do other cultures hold these archetypes? You know, are they, again, are they free floating? Are they actually very specific, you know, to maybe a European context? And not to say that they're wrong. It's just like, okay, when we add in other lenses, they actually, you know, enhance them and enrich them instead of somehow, you know, jostle for supremacy, which again is, as I think, was never the idea. So,
Ian, this time, what have you learned about yourself and your own soul? Because one of the things that Michael was talking about in that podcast is that we're talking about everything was inside. He didn't want to invite the media in. Mm-hmm. Because the minute you invite the media in, it's just like whenever you look like an electron when it's going through the double split slit experiment, suddenly it collapses, right? Mm-hmm. It changes it, and you can't do that. So now it's the time that we're having to take it out. And so what during these episodes that you have, what has been working on your own? Mm-hmm. Your soul and your own evolution. What have you been learning about Ian?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, like I said in the initial piece of how I came to it, was that, yeah, I felt like I disassociated, right, from those parts of myself. Mm-hmm. And so I think this journey of being in this, let's broadly call it men's work, right, from the last 5 or 6 years has been that reclaiming and coming back to what I feel like a degree of integration, right, of like, okay, wow, so, you know, those parts are part of me, this experience of masculinity and how I've experienced myself as a whole being, you know, is really important to integrate. And coming to recognize that, you know, that journey is obviously very, it's long, you know, it's not a sort of, oh, I did it now, check the box, move on. Yeah. And, you know, the more I dip into it, it's almost like, yeah, the horizon extends even further away, because you realize, okay, anytime you zoom in on one part, all of a sudden it opens up, you know, and there's a lot to explore there. So I would say certainly my edges now are looking a lot about what is, you know, what is true embodiment for one, you know, what are the gift of emotions, you know, and even in a I say it that way specifically almost to represent what I feel a lot of men experience, and I know I have in the past, which is, I would call it like a deep distrust of emotions, actually, mm-hmm. right? Like they seem a bit too wild, a bit, you know, just kind of anarchic and not, what, you know, what's the point other than to simply lose control of, you know, where control and self-mastery seem to be the order of the day for, you know, men in this culture. And so coming to a place of trusting their intelligence has also been an edge for me. And I have been, you know, looking to step more into direct practice, because again, even over-intellectualizing, of course, is another trap, you know, for myself, and a lot of men experience that of, you know, oh, interesting. I, you know, I thought about it and therefore I understand it rather than I've embodied it and integrated it. Right. And maybe lastly to say shadow work, you know, of course, which is a big piece. You know, I've done the Mankind Project, New Warrior Training, which, you know, they mm-hmm. do some shadow work there. I also have spent a few years in a community in Portugal called Tamara, of which they have a lot of sort of gestalt, kind of psychodrama work they do in community, which has been really instrumental for me to see how we can bring forth shadow and have it held in a wider community vessel and actually have it enhance trust in the community instead of break it. And, you know, I've spent, you know, many times in there as well to kind of uncover and to be seen and to integrate in all these places. So yeah, I got a long way to go, and I feel still, yeah, very much a, you know, newbie in this realm.
I've got a question. You get it, the divine masculine, the divine feminine within us. And we can have this conversation because mm-hmm. we can both touch into that. Mm-hmm. What about the conversation with the toxic masculine? Mm-hmm. What about the fellas that are there? Can you connect with them? Can you relate to them? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that. You know, I feel this question, I mean, it almost comes from often, I'm not saying you're saying this, I experience it often as a kind of, you know, how do we make them like us? Or, you know, something like that, right?
right. Did it sound like that?
and it's a, you know, it's a sincere thing. And I'm wondering, yeah. I feel when we see, like I said, you know, look out and you see all the, you know, chaos and violence and you're like, you know, how do we stop this? So
yeah.
I feel like it comes from that place. And I guess I've recognized how there is such a gift in meeting men where they're at, you know, mm-hmm. certainly. And I find often, you know, we can speak in this way and certain language can be, you know, above accessibility for a lot of men, right? Who
right.
are kind of like, what are you talking about? And I think therefore it's really important to be able to embody those very, you know, qualities whereby I would say this, you know, something switched for me a little while ago when I recognized, you know, it wasn't so much about changing men that I encountered as it was to, you know, be that messenger. Do you know what I mean? And I don't want to trot out the kind of cliche, you know, be the change you wish to see. But for example, I began walking through life not kind of reflexively othering men. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like a kind of, you know, he doesn't get it, or all the ways, right? When we kind of set up a sort of internal hierarchy, right, of competition. Sure. Even if, you know, you're pretty spiritually advanced, you know, I think it's still there. And whether it's
yes.
Right. Yeah. So whether it's the construction worker, you know, the, I don't know, guy behind the counter with the retail shop or something, I just kind of shifted my orientation to just be, to see him, you know, as if, imagine this man was in my men's circle. Do you know what I mean? Like, how would I treat him? How would I talk to him? How would I, you know, would I just stay in a kind of, what's the word? Like a commodified transactional relationship, you know, like, oh, you know, he's just bagging my groceries, you know, or would yep. I just shift a little bit and not, you know, not make him uncomfortable and say, you know, hey, what's alive for you in this moment? Like, you know, but just be able to see him as a brother. Right. And just kind of hold that kind of energetic solidarity. I guess that's how I'd say it. And that to me is more powerful than, you know, maybe throwing a copy of Iron John at him and saying, you got to read this, you know, because I think they'll come to it when it's their time, if that is their path. But that, you know, again, how we embody it and generate that field of, yeah, like trust, solidarity, you know, holding, calling them forth, I think is where it really, we become bridges.
Mm. You know, you're talking about holding this form. One of the terms that we use is holding space for somebody. Mm-hmm. And in our circle, when we come together, we'll have 20 or 30 guys every Monday night. And, that's so much of what we're doing. And part of it is teaching ourselves not to jump in there with the solution, not to try and fix the guy, but create a space where healing can happen, mm-hmm. and to hold that for that fella. Mm-hmm. It's so powerful. Mm-hmm. It really
found.
Is.
I've experienced it over and over again. Mm-hmm. Ian, we've had men, more than one, whose wife either died that day, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. had happened that week, that came, their first experience was to come into the circle, mm-hmm. and we sat with him as it happened. I mean, that was, I know that that sounds like an extreme example. There are many other examples, but the internal soul work mm. that we're seeing happening there, and that we're seeing, it feels to me, over my being the elder of these of you three, mm. it feels like something has fundamentally shifted, that there is an opportunity, there are opportunities for conversation mm. that have not happened before, which makes this all that more important. What mm-hmm. what is your sense about the time that we're in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what comes to me is, you know, this is something that's became more clear to me the more I talk to Indigenous people and how they hold specific cultural understandings, you know, for their particular culture. And I just want to highlight something which, to me, it feels almost like a, it's hard to see when it's the water you're in, right? Mm-hmm. That you know, you kind of have to step out of it to be able to be like, whoa, and then see it. Yeah. And so what I would say, the thing that is unseeable by this culture, and I speak maybe, you know, modern North America, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we are living in a time when so many of the ancestral lineages, right, have been lost, right? Like a lot of the Europeans, right, that came over in particular. And I'll say that, you know, I'm a second generation Canadian, as in my grandmother came from Ireland, whereas my, you know, father was born here, and, you know, me being here. And at the same time, you know, I know so little about Ireland. You know, I've gone back actually twice to experience it and to see family that are there, and it's been profound. And I'll say that we're living in the kind of aftermath of that, the wake of that, which means, and I'll say it this way, that, you know, there is no kind of universal, definitive cultural understanding for North Americans, right? By this meaning, we kind of have the absence of culture. Well, that's a better mm-hmm. way to say it, right? If we understand, like a teacher I've studied with many years, Stephen Jenkinson, he says that culture, real culture, is an achievement. You know, it's not a kind of, you know, like Charles Eisenstein as well, as a person I've collaborated with many times, and he says so many times when we get together, and even I'll speak about it with men, so many times we get together, we experience what could be called shared consumption, right? Like, you know, you watch the game, you know, you have a few beers or whatever. And you know, and that could be nice, you know, of course, a kind of friendliness. And at the same time, you know, it's not really a pathway to go deep. And that's just why, of course, where men's work come in, and you have the tools and the space holding to allow that, which is beautiful. And I guess what I'm saying is that the challenge, though, is to come up with a kind of universal response to the problem of universalism. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that quite makes sense, right? Which is, because when you talk to an Indigenous person across the board that I've experienced, I'll say, well, how do your men, you know, do this, or what are their rituals and this and that? Now, I've never heard one say, all people everywhere should do this. You know, all men everywhere need to do this, right? They always say, well, this is how we do it, right? Like, it's a very particular culturally specific understanding. And I'll say my understanding now of Indigenous culture is that it is primarily land based, or you could say land kind of generated, right? Like, it comes from a particular place and mm-hmm. therefore it's bound to a particular place. Whereas so many of us have a challenge of the men who don't have those ancestral lineages, right? Of coming up with a kind of cultural mandate, but so many of us don't have, you know, 1,000 years or so in the same place anymore to have that generated. So I guess what I'm saying is we get into a problem, which is we think a kind of universal response, let's get all men to go through this experience, you know, as the medicine, you know. But the challenge, of course, is that there's a diversity of kind of responses that are so needed. And so I guess that's what I'm saying. We're in this kind of unity and diversity, right, is the kind of way forward, rather than a kind of, we all need to do this thing, which is, you could hear it almost like a monotheistic kind of hangover, right? Like, there's one way, and let's all get them to join the one way. So I guess that's what I'm saying the opportunity for me is recognizing, you know, that like Dallas said, the indigenous fellow in the interview, he said, you know, I don't think that it's about, say, getting indigenous men into these kinds of, let's say, more modern men's work circles, because they got to do their own work with their people. You know, like there, yeah. There's deep healing work, and we have to do specific healing work, which is specific to our context. And I'll say for me, just, you know, with my skin color, is to look at whiteness and to look at, you know, privilege and to look at appropriation, all these things that are right. sort of necessary ingredients to coming up with a kind of deep, culturally informed response to men's soul work.
You know, as you were talking, going back to this whole we, they, one of the things that I've experienced over the past couple of years, or the past year and a half, I guess, is working with an organization called Gender Equity and Reconciliation International. And it's, in essence, creating a safe space to nurture and to allow deep healing between women and men, to recognize that we're all wounded by this patriarchal system. And our wounds are different, and we're not there to compare. But we're there to honor and respect and acknowledge that this is the first time this person may have ever spoken these words and into a mixed group, you know, and allow an alchemy to happen, a healing to happen. And in the same vein, when we're in our circle, a men's circle, we recognize that we're all wounded. We carry different wounds, and to be able to honor that. And I'm going to differentiate here between calling somebody out or seeking to get them to be authentic and nurturing and again, creating that space. Because I know for me, I didn't trust other men, right?
Yeah.
So I had to get over that, and I started a men's circle to figure that out, and I'm still figuring it out. But it's the one space where I can go during the week where I can work on connecting my head and my heart together, and then being able to speak it. I don't have that language, and to speak it in an environment there's no judgment.
Yeah, beautiful. I appreciate you said the distrust thing as well, because I think you're right that that level of undercurrent, I think, for a lot of men is sort of omnipresent. And I didn't actually even recognize it, maybe like many of you, until doing a bit more of the work and being like, oh, wow, I actually really don't trust men, you know, beyond a certain easy surface camaraderie.
Sure.
You know, yeah. And I think maybe the difference might be men who experience, for example, being in combat, you know, with other soldiers, or men who go through firefighters, or, you know, something like that, where they experience some kind of deeper challenge together, often life or death, you know, there can be a deep trust that emerges. But I think other men don't have that kind of experience and don't realize, yeah, how close to the surface that distrust actually is and how deep it goes, actually. And I do think that is a threshold that men need to cross in order to be able to start doing this work. You know, in another episode, I think it was maybe number 6, The Boy Hero Must Die, where we talked about this idea that, you know, that basically men who are willing to do this kind of work are all failed heroes. You know, like the hero as the lone wolf, the hero as the one who, you know, has it all together, who can do it all, you know, and they have to almost hit that wall and crumble, right, before they're like, oh, wow, I actually can't do this on my own. And now, wait, oh, there's other men around here who actually figured that out too. And, you know, that's the kind of way in.
When what was your failed hero moment?
Yeah, thank you. You know, in Robert Bly, Iron John, I think he says this in maybe The Road of Ashes, right, where he says a lot of men experience this around maybe 35-ish, and I was pretty much right on cue. at 33, actually, I got divorced. I was in a relationship for 10 years. We were married for 6. And it really was that kind of everything I thought was me and, you know, my life and everything burned to the ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were a lot of circumstances around why that happened and this and that. But essentially there was the moment when I had everything packed in my, you know, Subaru hatchback from the home that I had lived in with, you know, my partner and our picket fence and the dog and the garden and the whole thing. And everything I owned that I was taking with me fit in the vehicle, and I drove away. and, you know, the sort of next chapter began. And so from that, from those ashes really is where, you know, I was like, wow, I just can't, you know, everything I thought I could achieve at and win, you know, was over. And from that is where I found, wait a second. Yeah. I have to do things differently. You know, I have to find others and particularly men in order to, you know, help me see what are my blind spots, you know, what don't I know about myself actually without the capacity of, you know, men who can see and have done their work as well that could mirror for me and hold me in that.
Yeah. And that's got to be men with men. Mm-hmm. I get some people say, well, Clay, you need to open up your circle for men and women. I said, no. There's work mm-hmm. that men have got to do with men. And I've mm-hmm. said this a thousand times, but you know, we get 20 or 30 guys in a circle on a Monday night.
Yeah. Wow.
And, we've got over 1,000 life years of experience right there. Mm. I think there's something we can learn from each other. And once we've done that and we've learned how to speak, then we can now take the next step and begin to integrate and heal, you know, with our spouse or partner or women.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. You know, it makes me think too, that just the last thing about that, the, you know, it's easy to see, I think, that there is an ancestral echo there, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, if we were living in village still, where it would be natural mm-hmm. for a kind of village intelligence for at times, right, the men to gather together and to, you know, do that work, and then the women together. And likely a lot of indigenous understanding had a third gender, right, or a kind mm-hmm. of two-spirit or whatever it was, and they probably had specific work that they would do. And so in that sense, when we gather together, we are recreating that ancestral, you know, echo, that ancestral memory of how it would have been before, you know, industrialization and fragmentation and colonization and all the rest. So I feel like that touches a place of deep longing that a lot of men carry as well, right? To have a degree of a kind of like, oh, wow, this is how humans actually lived, you know, for 99% of our history, you know.
Yes. Before, right? Yeah. Is there something there, Ian and Clay, about the idea that this idea of a nuclear family that is cut off from others, as opposed to us being a tribal species, where in a tribe it actually would knock the edges off of some of this, that the stuff you wouldn't be able to get away with, mm-hmm. and you would have to confront and deal with in a more tribal, if we were more interconnected, and as we're trying to redo it digitally now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can chime in on this. You know, it's interesting that the word tribe came up with Bill as well, because he has a new sort of initiative, right, called Time for Tribe. And it was really looking at how to build really like small scale, I would say like almost like a village pod, right, of people that are really in with you, you know, like you really build deep trust with mixed gender that could really hold each other and all the rest. And again, like I think a beautiful initiative. And you know, the word tribe to me also has a kind of challenging affiliation. You know, again, we talk about appropriation or whatever, the kind of legacy, right, of colonization.
Sure.
And I looked it up, actually. It's initially a Latin word, you know, that the Romans used, right? I think it meant a sort of particular, yeah, group of almost pod would be another way to say it too, within a wider Roman, you know, larger city state. And then it later became used by anthropologists to denote kind of African primitivism. Right. So we'd say, oh, they're tribal living as a kind of primitive, you know, pre-civilized label. And then I think more currently we tend to use it. Yeah. So then more currently we tend to use it as a kind of like what I would like to say, a kind of villagey way. And this is also why I tend to use that word instead, because I feel like it kind of just releases it from a primitivism or a kind of a unconscious primitivism.
I like that.
Yeah. 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 Because then I think what happens is, you know, because this is the kind of prejudice that modernity does when it looks at other cultures, right, and says, oh, you know, they're basically pre-us, right, which is a fascinating way to think about it, right? Like, oh, yeah, and even when we say developing nation, right, it's the same thing. It's like, oh, they're basically on their way to being like us because, you know, we're great and clearly we're, you know, better, so they'd want to be us. Whereas a lot of indigenous people, of course, are like, no, we don't want to be you, actually. But the more that one is able to see the deep intelligence of, for example, like village living, right? And even how you are with a place, you know, like, you know, hunting, gathering and all this kind of stuff, again, has a kind of primitive romanticism in a way, but there's a deep intelligence to village as a, almost like a, a limitation on how many humans can be somewhere for how long, right? Like, and you know, you hear stories too, I think of groups of, I think it's maybe 150 is the sort of village number, right? Where you can kind of have a real relationship with approximately 150. You might've heard this, there's studies done, right? And maybe you remember the, enough of the names or the stories. And after that, you sort of lose track, right? There's just kind of too many people. And there's a really interesting, almost biological intelligence in that, right? When you recognize that, again, too many people in one place too long tends to degrade the place, right? And we see that in a lot of places. You know, the Fertile Crescent, you know, is largely desertified. And yeah, so many places where, of course, like the diversity is very, is mostly gone, you know, because again, humans have just didn't leave, right? Whereas you see the intelligence of nomadism, right, to move around is because they recognize, okay, what, we can only be here so long for the season.
Right.
We got to keep moving. Because when we come back, you know, a year or whatever later, it'll be able to regenerate. And that was a place, that was a way of loving the place. So I guess I'm saying all this to say that there's something about the village, again, intelligence, which is beyond a kind of, let's borrow sugar occasionally, you know, or even community gets trotted out a lot. You know, when people say, oh, I live in a great community, you know, maybe it's the burbs. And again, it's kind of like, because so many of us have never had the lived experience mm-hmm. of what it actually means, you know, and I would actually say having now, I've lived in a collective project now for a number of years where we have anywhere from, you know, 8 to 10 intergenerational people living together with a lot of these practices that I've incorporated, you know. And what we find is that, you know, it's actually, it asks more of you because it, like you say, you can't hide in a lot of ways. and we particularly go after a lot of shadow stuff, you know, when we're in here with the work we do.
Right.
And so in some ways it's almost like an evolutionary fast track, you know, whereas the nuclearized fragmented families, it's like so many blind spots go unchecked, right? A lot of mayhem that kids have to bear,
amen.
Right? Because the adults are just, you know, they don't have other adults to call them on it and be like, whoa, 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 you know, you have to see this, you know, and no more and all the rest. So I guess I see that the, you know, the kind of, I don't know, I call it a diversion or like a deviation called the nuclear family is, again, a very recent phenomenon from the way that we've been living. And for so many, yeah, it feels almost like, oh, it's always been this way. You know, vaguely there's an idea that we had, you know, village in the past, but it's such a standard, such a recent just departure from the intelligence that we used to live. And so I just think it's really important to see it that way. You know, even as we can't leap back to village, yeah. But we can begin to sort of reawaken the village imagination.
Boy, I tell you what comes up for me, and this is kind of shallow, but down in the South, you know, we say, well, the neighborhood, you know, everybody would take care of each other's children and everybody play around, but and people would sit on the front porch and they'd wave at each other walking by and so forth. Yeah. And as soon as the air conditioner was invented, everybody went inside.
Yeah.
And we've been inside ever since. Wow. And I can't say what's the last name of the person that lives next to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's that phenomenon. It's just as simple as that.
I love that reawaken the village imagination because there's something there. There's something within us. It feels like that whatever is happening is more a process of subtraction than addition.
Mm-hmm.
That it's there.
Uh-huh.
It's that we need to take away some of the things in order to allow it to naturally emerge rather than something that's missing that we have to glue in.
Yeah. 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 Beautiful way to say it. And I really love the link to the air conditioner example, you know, that Clay just gave, which is that, you know, technology is always a double edge, right? Like it giveth and it taketh away. Mm-hmm. and the kind of unforeseen consequence of something like air conditioning, like you said, is in some ways catastrophic to village life or to neighborhood life, where you're right. The inability to sit inside when it's hot means, oh, there's more eyes on the street means, oh, hey neighbor. And conversations naturally happen and all the rest. And suddenly a convenience, right. Of like, oh, now I can be cool. You know, during the hot time, suddenly nobody's outside anymore. And I feel like this is the relationship to comfort often, which most don't recognize. You know, you might've seen that movie from the '80s. I think it's called Dinner with Andre. You know, it's kind of a classic. Yeah, yeah.
A little two-person yeah. conversation.
Exactly, yeah. And there's a beautiful riff in there. I can't remember the specifics, but basically he kind of makes that case. He's saying comfort is the thing that gets in the way of the ability to engage, to understand what's necessary or what's important, right? Because the distractions or the addiction to comfort, which you know, we have an entire culture, which that's the highest achievement, right? Is comfort. Yeah. Mm. And so it's very difficult to be willing to release comfort unless you have to, right? Unless you can't afford the thing, or unless, you know, all these other things will get in the way. But all of a sudden, most people, you know, tend to recognize, you know, you see in the aftermath of big calamities, you know, weather events or floods or anything, it's like suddenly now you have to know your neighbor, you know, because they're throwing sandbags down, you know, next to you, or wildfires. Suddenly it's like you're next to your neighbor, you know, in your car fleeing, and all of a sudden, hey, what, we never even met and here we are. So it's like these calamities often create the conditions whereby suddenly we need each other again. And so this is what I mean by, in some ways, it's a hard thing not to wish for, you know, that the comfort gets less comfortable, you know, because again, it feels almost totally antithesis to what we've been conditioned to want in the culture, which is, you know, comfort above all else. And, you know, the times are as they are, you know, likely means that comfort can't go on as it's gone on, you know, without higher and higher cost, of course, to the biosphere and to those that, you know, are less up the chain. And so this is a lot of what's happening with Black Lives Matter, I think, and others where, you know, it's really like the feedback is finally getting through in the system to say, hey, like, we can't go on like this and we need each other.
Do you seek, considering we're in July of 2020 when we're recording this, do you see COVID and the global pandemic as having an impact? I mean, just to put this into context, last night I read on the news that the Bahamas is barring travel from the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, let that sink in. Mm-hmm. The Bahamas is barring us, United States citizens, from coming. And when they have a tourist-based economy. So something's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's such a rich moment for a lot of reasons. And I draw upon the conversation I had with Martin Shaw in the podcast. He's a storyteller from the UK. And he does a lot of rite of passage work, you know, wilderness rite of passage stuff. And he had this great example where he said, specifically about COVID, but he said, you know, men can experience the same encounter with the wild, let's say, and have very different experiences, sort of things come from that, right? And he gives another example too of, say, being in war, you know, as a rite of passage, as an encounter with, you know, mayhem. And he says, you know, one can come back and turn to alcohol and drugs and totally devolve and, you know, end up in suicide. And another could turn that encounter into seeking an actual deeper healing path and, you know, find others. And so I guess that he's saying that the encounter alone doesn't guarantee an outcome, right, which is favorable. And so this is kind of what I feel also with COVID as well, which is, you know, many of us are experiencing a highly disruptive, you know, encounter with a being that is, you know, invisible and yet very consequential. And so how do we choose to relate to it and to, you know, go through that integration because of it? You know, some see it as an enemy, right, which is because it gets in the way of all of the things that they think they should be doing and the way they wanted to live their life. And so, you know, eradicate at all costs. Others say, wow, this is a wake-up call. You know, I realized that I wasn't that happy anyway, you know, maybe. And this is a great opportunity to turn towards, really, what am I here to do and all the rest. So, you know, that becomes their integration. I think as a kind of larger possibility, I think, yeah, we do have the opportunity for what I could call a kind of maybe global, you know, wake up, I could say, where, you know, we have the possibility of really shifting course, whereby, you know, 6 months ago, it would have been unheard of, you know, that most global air travel is grounded, you know, like that would have been a total impossibility, right, in the not that long ago. Or all of the things that people do that they say, oh, I could never give that up, you know, all of a sudden, here we are, and we're still, you know, if you're lucky enough, privileged enough, maybe you're still okay. So I guess that's what I'm saying, that the, you know, we really have a choice of how we respond and react to this. And I think these times, again, could be possibly, you know, generative in the long run, but only if we choose to make it so.
My fear is that, you know, one day we're going to wake up and we'll realize that COVID's going away. Mm-hmm. And we're going to rush back to the way it, quote, was. Exactly. And we will have not learned a lesson.
Yeah.
And,
Being the optimist of the group, yeah. I'm hoping that even if we did, but we just come back that we don't hit as high in the consumption meter as we are, that there's still this gap, and within that gap, yeah. within that gap is where all the magic is happening, because mm-hmm. it feels different. It feels mm-hmm. to me that because I'm trying to think of like 20 years ago, let's say that you wanted to start these conversations and you wanted mm-hmm. to have, how hard would it have been for you both, not just to find the people and get them, but get other people to listen. So there mm-hmm. is a wave component to where there's something amplifying yeah. the others that is going on right now. And when it hits me at this deep level, it's changing. I'm feeling it shift. Mm-hmm. And Ian, I want to ask you about something. Where are you, as you're looking out at the world of idea and edge walkers, mm-hmm. as you're working, where are you looking to have these conversations? Who are you? Mm-hmm. Who are the people that you're exploring to have these conversations with mm-hmm. on your podcast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I mean, you know, I'm lucky enough that largely most of the interviews I've done so far, which are close to 20 now, are all people I've crossed paths with or have a direct relationship with. So in some sense, yeah, in some sense, I'm just drawing upon the wealth of, you know, the circles that I've been in, you know, privileged to be in as a filmmaker, right? Where, you know, I've been able to go to a lot of incredible places, you know, like I said, Portugal, it's a place to Mira. You know, Finnhorn in Scotland. Mm. I attended something a few years ago called the New Story Summit, you know, again, which was like a nexus for all of these people doing, you know, deep change work. And so I really just kind of drawn upon that existent network to invite certain conversations, you know, which I've been grateful to have. And I'd say, yeah, the edges that I find most interesting now, like I said, you know, particularly interviews like Bayo Kamalafe, you know, the poet from West Africa, like his capacity to, you know, invite a different way of seeing, I think is so vital. And you know, he has a great, just sort of a, I don't want to call it a tagline, but it's come out a lot in his interviews, which he says, the times are urgent. Let us slow down. Right. And that paradox, right. Which when the fix it mind, you know, wants to get in there quick and be like, okay, what do we do? What do we do? That there's something else that's needed, a kind of courtship of slowness, you know, that allows for possibility to emerge. But if we move too quickly, all of a sudden, you know, we've lost it because you just sort of reenact more of the same, because how could we not, right? And so, yeah, I'm really intrigued by those that have that capacity to bring in a different kind of wondering. Yeah. And like I said, a lot of indigenous cosmologies, which I think are so vital to diversify the understanding, the ways of seeing, right? And I'll say in general, in particular now I speak of the context of North America, you know, aka Turtle Island, to a lot of indigenous folk, that, you know, we have a very particular context, which I feel is different than a lot of the rest of the world, in that, you know, we are still living in what could be called first contact, right? Like the idea that somehow, you know, it's over, it's done. Like that's a colonized understanding, right? That the past is gone and it's over and, you know, get over it and all the rest. And I think it's very possible that, you know, and by the grace of, you know, the indigenous folk that are now in a deep resurgence, mm-hmm. you know, which has been confirmed to me through a number of them, that there's a possibility here of really rebuilding right relationship, which I do think is the key actually to any livable future. No question. Like the fact that.
How beautifully said. Oh, that, yeah. Ian.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I feel like, because again, unless we're willing to, that is the shadow of this country or this nation, you know, Canada as well. This is the shadow that it was built upon, a genocide mm-hmm. of the indigenous people. And the willingness to really go there, right, is part of that slowness, I think, right? Because if we just approach indigenous wisdom, even as now is becoming more vogue, then we come with a kind of hungry ghost pillage mind, right? Like, save us. And, you know, I interviewed a Cherokee fellow for an interview, a film called Prayer for the Earth, based on his work. And he said it really well. He's like, you know, that's a bit much to think that, you know, suddenly we were the ones that were in the way of progress. And now we, you know, all of a sudden we're like, oh, progress isn't what it was meant to be. Now it's indigenous people save us, right? That's like, you know, the height of hypocrisy. And it's possible to court that true wisdom through slowing down and actually being willing to, you know, see what's been done to build that right relationship again. because again, there is no foundation without that. I feel like anything else is still built on very, you know, shaky, idealized, romanticized ground, right? Of this idea of the heroic pioneers and all this kind of stuff. Like, we'll just recreate more of the same, and the biosphere can't take it anymore. You know, so that is such the place to begin again.
That is. Ian, I want to ask you something just in general. What was the experience of becoming a father and having a boy? Mm-hmm. That experience and what that's both done to your soul and what you're thinking about, you know, what is going through your consciousness?
Yeah, thanks. You know, it's interesting that I recognize, you know, some men will say, I always wanted to be a father, you know, and they're kind of, they just knew it from a young age. And I'll say, I was wondering about it, you know, that part of me felt like maybe it's not for me, like maybe it's just not mine to do, until I met the woman that would become the mother. And it was, you know, they say that it sort of completed the circuit of, oh, okay, this is possible. And so that came on me a little bit by surprise. And that being said, you know, when he was born and now, as they say, he's, you know, bopping around and more boisterous every day. And it's been profound.
Boisterous and pun intended, right?
There you go. Yeah. And it's been profound to, I guess, tune back into, again, a kind of deep sense of wonder. You know, there's often that gift of mm-hmm. children. And again, to not to see a kind of unsullied, you know, blank slate, which I feel is a bit of this, you know, kind of projection on children as if they're somehow pure and, you know, we're the, you know, sinners and maybe, you know, they'll save us, you know, again, in this kind of unconscious way. But that's not that. It's more like, you know, the opportunity to really participate, I'd say, in just a longer arc, right? And there's some way that somehow by, you know, I see my parents differently, you know, through this process. I see my father mm-hmm. differently, you know, right? And now I'm seeing, oh, okay, wow, you know, wow, he must have, you know, I was like this with him. you know, I never heard about it, you know, when I was older, and suddenly, you know, more compassion, you know, is the result of that. And like I say, like what world will he grow up in, right? Like it kind of invokes a longer timeline. Whereas I feel those that maybe can land in a lot of cynicism about the day, right? They kind of collapse the idea of a conscience into being cynical about it and what's the point and all this stuff. And I'm not saying hold to a kind of wild optimism that is sort of ungrounded, you know, in a sense. And because I guess I'm saying I've been inspired by those that almost like proceed more, a bit more humility of like, you know, I don't know if we'll save anything. Right. And by that even, you know, again, what does it mean to save the world or save, you know, ourselves? But I think life will make it through in some way. Right. And so in some sense, I wonder, you know, could we, through the way that he's raised, you know, what skills could I offer him? Could he be around that might be useful, you know, in the future? And so that's the way I've tried to construct his life. And I'll say, I was never in a circle even until I was probably like 26, 27, right? It just wasn't part of my culture, my family, you know? Yeah. And I'll say with some degree of pride that my son, you know, he's probably been in like 200, you know, and he's not even two. And he's been around like really deep, you know, ceremony and ritual and village, you know, ways in some of the travels we've done and in the community here. And, you know, I got to think, you know, he does not consciously taking it in, but I highly suspect he's unconsciously, you know, absorbing the transmission of like, whoa, this is how humans are together, could be together. And I got to think, you know, again, you know, a decade, two decades, what will that translate to, you know, in terms of his ability to engage with the time and what's really needed. So that's what I'm saying. It created this longer arc of just seeing impact and consequence, you know, in my life and like previous, you know, fathers and now with him and the time to come.
Just to watch him grow up, they grow up fast. And I just, yeah. I've just come conscious of that, watching my little neighbor boy grow up. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's about three now. Wow.
And Clay, in your journey, as you've seen, you had your heart bypass, and that after a long career in the computer industry and all that, and really to have that big change, that shift for you, was that your death of the hero moment?
Oh gosh, yeah, and I only wish it happened when I was 35. Mm. You know, for me, it was 53. Yeah. And that's a whole story in itself, but I had a mystical experience that, that turned out to be a bypass operation afterwards. And, shortly after that, the market crashed, lost work, and was sitting on the sidelines for 2 years. And that was, for me, my dark night of the soul. And that's where I began learning about people like Joseph Campbell and John Bradshaw and, you know, Michael Mead, Robert Bly. So that started to come to the surface.
It's lovely to see Ian, to know what you're doing on the planet, and to know you, Clay, and to know what you're doing, and know what I'm doing on the planet, because this is where I feel that these conversations have that opportunity to be able to spread. We don't know who's going to be that one listener, that last listener, the one where, you know, where you have that sugar, where you have that avalanche, and that one last little is the one that breaks down, or at least makes some shifts that move along the way. But without these conversations, without us being willing to have these conversations, I would feel like I was not doing my part to be in on this process, and I want in.
Beautiful. I agree. I think it really invites, again, a kind of non-linear emergent process.
Yes.
Is what I understand it. Yeah, where, you know, this idea that, you know, the only way to change something is by stronger application of force. Right, which is, you know, I got to make somebody do that. And that's a very, I would call it on the, you know, if there is a pyramid, and that would be the lowest pyramid of achievement, I think, of the using force to change something. Because I feel there's another whole other intelligence from relationship and from, you know, I like to call these things like pollinating the noosphere. You know, the global intelligence of the planet, especially with this ability to have these conversations and kind of, you know, release them to the wild. And trust that whoever, you know, needs to listen does, right? And again, it relinquishes a kind of idea of any particular strategy, you know, other than trusting that life wanted this to happen and invited it. And, you know, clearly the three of us said yes, and here we are. And, you know, again, who knows down the line?
That's where I feel the very, I'm so glad you brought that up, because there does appear to me to be, you know, Jungian, or however you want to say this, or Emerson, or what this, the oversoul, the global, the group, the consciousness of humanity, this sense that we are contributing to lightening it, to expanding it, it appears to be that's a real thing, that this the idea of field theory, people are doing research into field theory, that this is something real. It's not just the airy fairy kind of 70s 60s kind of thought, that there's something there that we're going back to study again. Do you get that sense of that, Ian?
And I actually really like this understanding, or the image of a spiral, that I feel that, you know, the 60s, you know, from the conversations I've had,
sure,
from those that were there, and, you know, some that conceive of it as a kind of, oh, you know, lofty ambition, and ultimately we failed because, you know, it became the 70s, 80s, 90s, high consumptions continued to run rampant in the biosphere. And the way I see it too is that, you know, there's these times that are especially liminal, especially fertile, and that in the spiral understanding, you know, it's like that was a deep time, of course, of a lot of massive breakthrough and emergence, and then it needed time to really integrate and to, you know, kind of go under again. And the changes that were made, you know, we see all around us, I think, you know, whether it's computers and, you know, psychedelics and all this stuff. And now I feel like the spirals come back around, which is why I said in earlier that the mythopoetic movement feels like a second wave, but it's building upon what was done in the past. But it's now kind of, you know, the next generation is actually kind of buoyed by it. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And so this is the opportunity we have.
And one of the things in spiral dynamics, which you're referring to, I think, is that it's so important that, because once we move to that next level, the tendency is to deny that we were ever there. Like deny everything before that. But what has to happen is we have to completely, understand it's Wilbur or any of the others, that it has to be integrated. Yeah. We have to accept all our previous states and stages in order to be able to stay at that particular space on the spiral.
Yeah, I love that extra reminder too, that because I do see this as part of the challenge with polarization, right? That the almost like the more entrenchment in one's position, and I do see as a Canadian, you know, looking south, that I do feel there at least is a deeper kind of entrenchment, it feels like, mm-hmm. that left-right divide. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's almost like the each side is like looking at the other and saying, I would never think that way. You know, they're completely wrong, as opposed to, right, the invitation being, wow, I would totally think that way, actually, if I lived their life and, you know, had their experiences. And so it's a very different, I think, invitation to invite one into saying, I fully accept, you know, that that's how you feel and that's how you understand the world. And where can we make a bridge, right? As opposed to, you know, agree with me or you're canceled. You know, like it's a very miserly understanding of, I think, about how to move forward together. So
I what a lovely place to end for me. Clay, do you have anything else that you would like to share with this gracious light?
The one thing I would like to say is, Ian, I just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I hope and I think I know that we're going to have more.
I would love that.
Yeah. Likewise, I would love to be able to continue and to be able to be part of a part of this conversation, because everything that what we're saying and what we're getting a chance to do is to be part of the process. And this is, and it's process, not product, right? Yeah. So this is how it happens, as messy and as weird and as as 18-month-old running in and seeing the toys. It's just all part, you know, it's just all part of it. But anyway, thank you. Thank you, Clay. Thank you, Ian.
Yeah, very, very rich time. Thank you both.
See you next time.